It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Claret & Blue Podcast. We're delighted to be joined by a very special guest today, Mr. Paul Atkinson. Now, Paul, some Villa fans might have seen you on the pitch during the Wolves game a couple of weeks ago, but you're the brother of Claret & Blue legend, I think we can safely say, Dalian Atkinson. And we've invited you on today because we want to reminisce about Dalian. We want to talk about something that you and the Atkinson family are doing to try and something really positive in honour of Dalian and in his memory. So, first of all, thanks again for joining us. But do you want to kick off by talking us through the foundation that you guys are setting up?
Yeah, what it is really, it's trying to sort of inspire the next generation, really. Giving our future with the kids some sort of future, something to look forward to for themselves and some possibilities. With the foundation, it's really, we need to get some funding together so we can start supporting. It's really the generation from sort of ages 5 to 25, giving them some financial, all types of assistance, really, getting into the into sports. You know, it's not strictly just football either. It's any sports we're going to help them with. So, you know, it's getting them back into sort of the community, back into the community, what we used to do before. We played as a community, we lived as a community, we laughed as a community. So it's all about getting the people back in the community, really.
So if Villa fans or football fans in general who stumble upon our podcast, if they want to find out more about it or they want to get involved, is it accepting donations from the public?
It is, although the website is under, it's going under construction at the moment as well. So we're working on it. We've not sort of done the official launch of it yet. So we just, you know, it's in the background working at the moment. So you still can donate.
When we spoke off air, Paul, we're not going to go into massive details about the circumstances of Dalian's death, but it's one way I think that the family can really kind of try and get something positive that honours his memory.
That's absolutely right. It's so that he touched all of us. His football touched us, and we want his legacy to touch the next generation, really. So, you know, that's what it's all about, really, as well. So, giving them the same chances he had, more chances than we had, really. So,
I'll give you my little bit first. My memory of Dalian kind of playing for Villa in the early to mid 90s were that he was this kind of swashbuckling footballer who had got all the kind of weaponry, I suppose, in terms of, you know, he got the size of the guy, the pace, a fair bit of panache, the ability to strike a ball. Was that? Were you a footballing family? Were you a footballer yourself when you were growing up?
We were all growing up where we did and how we did, all we had was sports really to look forward to and focus on. You know, and Dalian was the younger of three brothers. So it was always a baby, he was always a little one dragging behind, who had to sort of like, when he started playing, because he would play with the younger kids, but they always want to play with us as well, being the older kids. So they had to step up their game, which is why he became so good as well. Because the competition every day was competition for him, playing out in the families itself, playing out in the streets, playing football on the street, doing track and field on the streets. It was all competition. So that's what he knew. That's what he knew. And to survive, that's why the way he was. He was sort of like, people say he was a bit brash and a bit, what's it? Yeah, he had to be. He had to be, otherwise he wouldn't have survived at home, you know, so, yeah.
So were you kind of making sure that if he wants to play with the big boys, he's going to have to look after himself? We're not going to do any favours, you need to
him being the youngest, it's pecking order, wasn't it? Pecking order, and unfortunately that age, you got the shit end of the stick, didn't you, really? So, you know, that's just the way it went. You have to learn, you know, so that's what I'm doing, so, you know.
So at what age did kind of he and the family learn that actually he's a bit good here?
Well, he was never that good. No. No, he's a younger brother. He's just a younger brother, that's all. Fair enough, you can play football, but so what? You know what I mean? It's young, just some younger brother sort of thing. School days, really. Obviously, because being that much younger, we didn't really pay him that much attention. You know, because he was just a snotty little kid, wasn't he? So he's not paying that much attention. He just got in the way most of the time. But, you know, but later on during school days, he started to show potential. But then again, my elder brother was an excellent, great footballer. Absolutely brilliant. I played for, obviously, school teams, that sort of stuff as well. So if you imagine it, we're all older than him. He's the youngest one. He didn't look that good until we'd actually left school and he'd started, you know, when he went to sign for Ipswich Town. And I thought, oh, he's probably all right, isn't he? So he's probably all right, yeah. After all this, he's probably all right at football. So, you know. So well, we didn't notice it because he was just a little brother, really. So, you know, until he actually made it. So, yeah.
So was that a bit strong? Were you still, I'm just trying to think, so would he have been like kind of late teens when he signed for Ipswich? Would you still be living at home by then, Paul? Or
No, he was still at home. I'd already left home by then, but he was still at home. He was still at school. So one of our school teachers was liaising with his manager at Ipswich Town so he could go down to Ipswich and play and then come back to school and do his as well. Well, I suppose he'd done his exams. I don't think he'd done many of them anyway. Didn't need to. If he signed a professional football team, last thing he's going to do is do his exams, really. He didn't need to do that, did he?
Given the character that he was, that wouldn't have fazed him kind of moving away at an early age and stuff? Or...
Lord, it's difficult to explain. I suppose with the competition for him was a bit of a hostile environment. I suppose our upbringing, we didn't have a hell of a lot. Our parents weren't that great to us, so I think he was glad to get out and spread his wings, because if under that constriction for that all that period of time, his first chance you've got of freedom, you're going to take it, aren't you? So which is that's what football was for him. So it's a way of getting away, getting out of it. So he could be whoever he wanted to be playing football. You know, so he could perform, he could do whatever he wanted to be who he wanted to be. You know, that it was sort of like, I don't know, I suppose all the years of captivity growing up, you know, it's like, you know, he just opened the cage and he flew away and that was it. He's a footballer, so, you know.
He didn't really want you guys to turn up and watch him. What was the phrase that he used?
No, it was like, he goes, I don't come to where you work and watch your guys work, do I? I went, nah, it's all about going out after. It's all about us going out and enjoying ourselves after. That's what it's all about. Because when you're at work, you're under control, aren't you? Somebody's telling you what to do. It doesn't matter what it is. You can work for somebody, you're there, you've been told what to do. And if life is about when you've left work and you can actually enjoy yourself and be who you want to be instead of being somebody that people expect you to be. So
he'd kind of have his game head on, and rather than thinking he's got to look after you as well when you're at the ground, let me do my business and then we'll go out and we'll have a pint. That's or we'll right, celebrate.
Yeah. You know, what do you want to watch me running around the pitch sweating for?
This is an Aston Villa podcast and we've got super fond memories of Dalian. I mean, obviously the big, we've talked about his style of play as a footballer, but I remember, I mean, this is how old I am and this is how far we're going back, but we used to have these kind of season DVDs that would have like your goals compilations and they'd have a little bit of behind the scenes footage, and you'd always have Dalian and Dean Saunders kind of messing about and being like the ringleaders in the dressing room and being the life and soul of the party. Was that an accurate kind of portrayal of what he was like?
Yeah, he was, because even if we didn't, well, then very rare you didn't hear him, but even if you didn't hear him, you knew he was there. You could feel the vibes. He was there. You knew. Walked in the room. I know he's here. You can just feel the vibes. You know. He's up to no good somewhere. You know. So yeah.
During his career, obviously, you know, the Premier League had only just kind of in terms of it becoming the big beast that we know it is now. The Premier League had only just taken off, hadn't it, in the early 90s? But did he ever go to his head, Paul? Was he ever big time, or did you all? Because as big brother, you could always take him down a peg or two, anyway.
Yeah, but after a while, he wouldn't listen to you anyway. He just sat single-minded. He just do what he wants to do anyway. So it doesn't matter what you said. He'll made his mind up. That's what I'm going to do anyway. So, you know. But he wasn't not big-headed in that respect. No, he liked his flash things. He liked bright, pretty shiny things. But but you know, I don't think he was big-headed. I don't know. No, it wasn't. He was single-minded, not big-headed.
So give us a flavour of some of the shiny things. Then was he rocking up in kind of super flash sports cars and
always Always, because obviously, because round here we had our community. We all grew up together, sort of thing. Whenever he's playing away or whatever, and he say, right, okay, I'm back down for the weekend. So he'll give me a call and go, right, I want to know who's driving what. So I want to make sure that I come down with a better car than what everybody else is driving around there. And that's just the way, that's your competition. That's what happens every single time. So, you know.
So what? So these Ford Escorts parked all around the estate, and he comes and rocks up in what kind of thing would he be driving?
Well, Maserati bi-turbos, Ferrari, was that 355 Spider, was it? Yeah. It also, Lotus, most remember his Lotus Carp as well. He's obviously, he's at Villa when he had the Lotus Carp as well, and that thing was awesome. So, yeah. I suppose it had to go with his old persona, everything had to be flash. So he had to have a nice car dressed really bright and flashy so people can see him coming. Just him. So, you know, you knew it was him, you know. So from a distance, you know it was him. So, yeah.
When he came to Villa, obviously became part of what was. I mean, we hope that we're on the brink of something special now under Unai Emery. But in terms of the football that we're playing now, you probably do have to go back to the Ron Atkinson era, which included the likes of Dalian, for Villa to be playing that kind of swashbuckling style. Do you think, obviously, Dalian over his time would have played for quite a few clubs, but do you think Villa was a good fit for him at that time?
It was perfect for him. It happened at the right time. I know when he first signed, he was injured for a while. I mean, but in essence, I think that game saw ages ago, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when he's at the start, so he got in there, I suppose. Yeah, it just fitted nice. He's been sharing. It's sad people around here anyway, so you know. Where he's from, so it fitted nicely into him. You know?
And did that kind of help him? You think that he was back home effectively, or did that never bother him? Or
yeah, he did love playing. He loved playing for Villa. He really really loved it. The fans were really really. You know, even when they used to call him sick note, he knew that they were just trying to wind him up. Just because he was economical with his energy sometimes when he was playing. he knew that he was loved, and that's what mattered. You know, that's all that mattered. And that helped him to play better as well. So I remember Ron talking about, you know, don't you really show up physically at the big, important games. But why? That's economical, isn't it? That's all about, really.
We went to interview Ron a month or so ago for this podcast, and he was speaking about Dalian, and he said exactly that you've just said. You know, you might not notice him for a while, but when he wants to be involved, he'll come along and he'll just explode into action. And I think he was saying, it might have been when he was at Fenerbahce, I mean, I don't know how true this is, but he said that Fenerbahce, the president there, offered him some magnificent sports car or some bonus if he scored a certain amount of goals, and he kind of done it within the next 3 weeks or something. Does that ring true?
Yeah, that's true. Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. You know, that sort of stuff, though. Give him a chat. Something what's difficult to do, a challenge, he's up for it. You know, that's who he's up for. Which is why the easy stuff, you know, obviously the easy stuff, it's just too easy, isn't it? You don't get the recognition for doing easy stuff, just for doing the really difficult stuff. That's just what about, really. You have to shine, so, you know.
Was he one of these annoying people, Paul, who was good at everything, kind of, sporting-wise? Was he? I presume he was a good athlete and other team and individual sports, he would have shone, would he? Or
yeah, I suppose he used to play a lot of basketball as well. He loved basketball, and I suppose he's a good athlete, really, as well. Although I've got to say, you know, he wasn't as good as me. So I suppose with a big brother, like, he's got to follow him on footsteps anyway, and that's going to encourage him to perform better as well, isn't it? If he's always chasing behind somebody, well, his big brother, so to speak. So yeah.
So the one moment you probably guessed that I wanted to speak about Dalian in terms of his time at Villa was the goal away at Wimbledon, which
it still
gets played on highlights reels, and I've still it's the combination of the fact that somebody with such kind of power as Dalian, and when he can also display that kind of finesse and on the kind of pitches, I think we sometimes forget that we play on bowling green pitches now compared to what they used to be then. And that, I think that was at Selhurst Park, wasn't it? So talk us through your memories of that goal.
I probably saw it about a couple of days after, it's on about, I thought, yeah, it's all right. It's all, yeah, it's all right, yeah, good. You know, but you don't really, I suppose, as I said before, as my brother, you don't really feel the full, the value and the essence of it. Cause it's like, yeah, it's still my little brother, isn't it, at the end of the day. So it's all right, you should have gold at the end. Yeah, okay, I've shown you that loads of times. Loads of times at the park.
I love that. I love how there's something in that sibling rivalry that means you've got to hold something back and you can't quite admit how brilliant it is, because it'd mean your brother getting one up on you. I think it goes down as one of Villa's most classic celebrations as well, doesn't it? I don't know how much Dalian had to play in that, but it's obviously the fella with the umbrella, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. But I think Ron mentioned that and he goes, it's a shame it wasn't a bigger club at the time, because he goes, if that was at Villa Park and that happened, the roof would have come off. You know what I mean? They'd have blown the place to pieces. Absolutely awesome.
Yeah. You know? I kind of quite like the fact that it was somewhere rough and ready, though. And you got the big open away terrace, and you got the fella who and I tell you that what I like about that umbrella celebration. I don't know whether you'll have seen it, Paul, but I'm sure I've seen, there's like, you know how they do these kind of special Sabutio pieces that capture moments? I'm sure there's like a special Sabutio piece that's got kind of Daly and Dean Saunders. I think Ray Houghton comes and joins as well.
Yeah.
And I think they've called him Umbrella Man or whatever. Rain Man, I think the Villa fans have christened him. I think there's this little Sabutio piece. So I think my Sabutio set's still stuck at my mum and dad's loft somewhere, but I might see if I can try and buy that special piece. It's just a lovely moment. It's one of those real kind of moments that will live forever, I think, in Villa fans' memories.
You know, it is as well, especially the interaction from the crowd as well, which, like, you know, so yeah, absolutely brilliant. You know, absolutely brilliant.
30 years since Villa won the Coca-Cola Cup against Manchester United at Wembley, and obviously I always joke about Dalian's goal, because I was sat behind that goal, and it just seemed to take absolutely ages for that ball to cross the line. It seemed it was like time stood still, really. But would you have been at Wembley that day, Paul?
No, I wasn't. No. I did try to get some tickets off me. He goes, no. I'm like, all right, I'll watch it on telly. Don't worry about it.
So he was sticking to, even for the cup final, he'd stick to his usual rule of,
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And what would your feelings have been like, kind of watching that on the box then, and seeing him score the goal and seeing,
especially the first goal as well. It's like, the thing is, they played their socks off as well.
Yeah,
you know, and Dalian, he was putting in the effort that game as well. He was doing a bit of running around. You know what I mean? You know, he's probably had one of those. Them stepometers or something on him at the time. I don't know. trying to go for his record steps that day, but I don't know. But it was absolutely phenomenal. Scoring the first goal, he would have scored the third as well, wouldn't he? Would set for the Chanskalskis. Well, Chanskalskis handballed it. So
of course he got sent off.
Yeah, he got two that day by rights. It was phenomenal just watching it. And it was virtually all my guys I worked with as well. They supported Man United as well. So you know.
Oh, brilliant.
So it was. It made things that much sweeter.
So obviously, you said there with him scoring the goal in a cup final win, and him, Ron, saying that he's the man for the big occasion. Did he ever suffer from nerves?
He must have done, because you don't know what reception you're going to get, do you, when I go on a pitch sometimes. Yeah. Especially back in them days as well. You didn't know what sort of reception you're going to get. So, you know, you will get nervous at times. Yeah, definitely.
I think sometimes there's a feeling that just when we're on the brink of something, you know, it almost like Villa flirt with you, and then the carpet gets pulled, and then you have to start again. And there's obviously that when we won the European Cup in the 80s that we thought we were then going to go and dominate for years, and then we were relegated within 4 years. And I think with Big Ron, when we won that trophy, I think we thought, and we were, I think we came runners up to Man United in the league, didn't we, in the first year of the Premier League. I thought we were going to really, I don't know, go on to achieve massive things again. And I just wonder if, you know, I'm probably being a bit, you know, we can't change what's gone in the past, but Dalian probably could have stayed at Villa and become a career player at Villa, but circumstances just didn't work out that way.
Yeah, that's right. Whether something, obviously, he went to Villa originally from, obviously, he was in Sociedad, wasn't he? And and Ron.
Yeah, because Ron knew him at Sheffield Wednesday, didn't
that's
he?
Right, and then yeah, and he always said, he goes, Ron was grooming me when I was at Sociedad. He's ringing me all that stuff, telling me all these great things. He's going to that at the Villa. He goes, I've got a load of great stuff. No, I've got to do this, I'm going to do that. He goes, come on, David, come on. And not me. And he goes, oh. And he had him, so he went down. He goes, I'll come down to play for him again at Villa and that. So, but I think after a while, it's obviously you get, you know, that period probably got a bit disgruntled after a while, or, you know, things weren't going his way, or yeah. Actually, it was like at times, something wasn't going his way. I'll go, you know what, I'm out of it, I'm going to do it my way anyway, so.
Do you think Ron was a kind of good mentor for him during the time that they were together?
Nothing against Ron, because Ron's a businessman, but Dalen was just, a kid who's made it to the big time. So yeah. he didn't fully understand what business was about.
Yeah.
So he might have taken some of the things that Ron had said or done as personal or whatever, but it was business, you know. Yeah. It's probably, I think, yeah, Dalen was a bit more business-minded, focused. He might have stayed there.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, that's it, really. So I don't think Ron did anything wrong at all. It's just there were, you know, clash of personalities, really, so.
Yeah,
I'll tell you something funny. When Dalen used to be playing away, and I'd ring up the hotel where he's playing in sometimes, and the odd occasion, I think one they put me through Ron's room. Right, I'm talking about, he goes, oh no, it's not me. He goes, you want that lazy back in the other room? He's going, I'm like, shut up, you fat asshole.
Because you forget, don't you, sometimes, that mobile phones wouldn't have existed back then. So if you wanted to get hold of him, you'd have to go that way to get hold of him.
Yeah, yeah.
You must have been immensely proud of what he achieved as a footballer.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, because when he came back home, he was a prodigal son that's come home. He dreamt the impossible dream and it happened. So absolutely brilliant.
All the success that he had as a footballer, to you, he's your little brother, though, isn't he? So, you know,
that's right, yeah. You know, that's it exactly, yeah. It doesn't matter how, that's right, yeah, no matter how famous you get, he's still my little brother, isn't he, at the end of the day?
What I wanted to just finish on, Paul, was just to say, I think you've been talking 8 years on now since Dalen passed, and, you know, a personality and, you know, a loved one, like that must leave a kind of massive void in your life and the lives of your family. And just without it sounding like too trite a question, just how are you all doing now? Is the foundation and the bench? Actually, we never spoke about the bench, did we? What talk to me about the memorial bench
during the case, during the court case. Obviously, we're asking friends to try and help us sort stuff out in the background, because we're too busy involved in the proceedings, whatever. So the bench is something we've been trying to get a memorial done for ages, for years, to be honest. And I think I connected with our local councillor, Sean Davis and his team, and they said, well, that's at least they can do, you know, for Dalen, you know, the Telford schoolboy. They just come on board with me and, you know, said, all right, you know, gave us some ideas of what we can have, where we can have it. And we just went from there, really. And we found a local guy as well, Trevor, who's a fabricator, who designed the bench and that. And he just blew me away, really. So, you know, it's been a long time coming, but it should have been done years ago by rights. It's on the route where we used to walk to school, and our junior school was right next to it as well. And in the beauty spot as well. It's really nice areas. Kids where we can walk past and see who he was and see what he achieved, and it makes them think, you know, I can probably do that as well.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's all about, really. So, you know, to inspire the next generation going forwards.
No, it's a really, really nice and kind of fitting gesture. I was halfway through asking just about, again, just how the family's doing, Paul, really.
Well, we've been in a quagmire of emotion since. It's like, it's just when people say to you, life-changing events, it's like this sort of thing. We used to say, this doesn't happen to you. This is stuff, what you read about, happening to other people. So when it happens to you, nothing can prepare you for it, really. you know, and the devastating effect this had on the whole family, really. So we're never going to be the same again. And I suppose as well, it made it worse when, because it took 5 years to go to court. So we were left for sort of 5 years with no support, nobody really in our corner. Nobody was going to come and say, okay, let me come and give you guys the support, because we knew what happened, but nobody knew what happened. So it's very reluctant. A lot of people are going to come and support you, and they're going to turn around at the end and go, oh, he was guilty for something after all.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the way I felt, along with not being given any sort of support all the way through until they found out that he wasn't wrong. And then some people have gone, oh, we can come on board now, and, you know, which is, you know, obviously nothing's going to bring him back, but it's not going to help us either, really. So
it's kind of, it's not only the grief, but it's also the kind of the fight for justice. It's a kind of double whammy, isn't it?
It's isolation as well, you know, for that period of time. I mean, you know, we're still talking with me, sister, my brothers and that, and I'm like, I still don't know why it took 5 years to get to court.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's so surreal, you know. But it is what it is, and it's all about the future, it's all about living anyway. It's, you know, life is about the living, so, it's, you know, that's what we're focusing on there, trying to get ourselves back together, really.
Oh, well, listen, I know that you, like I said, you were paraded on the pitch with some of the 94 heroes at Villa Park the other week, and I hope that you kind of felt the love and support from the Villa fans that day.
Absolutely awesome. I was suffering anxiety or whatever, but I think everything went when I went on the pitch, you know, so it's to feel that love, it's somehow. I mean, thing is, that's what would have been, Damien would have been feeling every time he went on the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, I suppose that will make you do the impossible when you've got that much love pointed at you. So, you know, it's really good, really great.
No, well, listen, thank you so much for joining us. Like I said, it's Darren Atkinson will forever remain in our hearts and in our minds as a Villa legend. And I've really appreciated just taking that little trip down memory lane to get a sense of who he's like get a sense of what he was like from somebody who knew him best. So thank you, Paul Atkinson, for joining us. You've been watching the Claret and Blue podcast, and Dalian, we love you, mate. So rest easy, and thank you for the memories, and thank you, Paul, for your time.
Thanks for inviting me on as well. Which really appreciated.